Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, deported migrants are arriving in Turkey from the Greek island of Lesbos. A team of international journalists publishes findings into offshore financial dealings. We'll hear about a robot with human emotions.
When Salman told Nadine, "You were horrible," Nadine, you know, got this angry look on her face and said, "No, you are. I don't like you. I don't want to talk to you."
And we'll look at three new members to be inducted into country music's most exclusive club. It's right here on The Voice of America. The first group of Syrian refugees sent from Turkey under a controversial program have arrived in Europe. Meanwhile, deported migrants have been sent to Turkey from the Greek island of Lesbos. Correspondent Luis Ramirez is on Lesbos and joins us on the line. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, Susan. Well, the first three ferries left Greece on Monday, carrying the deportees. These are people who, under the deal signed by the EU and Turkey, are being returned to Turkey, although their nationalities vary. Greek officials told me that the majority, in fact, the words used were almost all of the migrants returned on Monday were Pakistanis. Only two of them were Syrians, who Greek officials say opted not to apply for asylum and were going to Turkey for family and personal reasons. Now, there were, as I said, three ferries that left, two of them from Lesbos, another one from the nearby island of Chios, where there are also detention centers where migrants are being kept.
What was the sentiment there? Were people angry or were they accepting of this?
Inside the camps, a great deal of tension because people have made it this far. It's a dangerous journey from Pakistan and certainly from Syria. And had gone through great trouble, great expense, great personal risk to make it as far as Greece, which is, of course, part of the European Union. And to be sent back was a major disappointment. So there had been indications from within the camps, from the refugees themselves, that there could be violence on the day when the EU officials would be escorting these people onto the ferries. That did not happen. What happened was that the European Union, as part of a deal, sent hundreds of border guards from throughout the European Union to this island to help carry out the process. It was carried out in a rather secretive manner where reporters were not told what time the transports would be taking place, nor were they given direct access to the embarkation process. And so these things happened in the pre-dawn hours. All we saw were buses, empty buses. All I saw were empty buses were entering the Moria Detention Center, which is the largest of the camps on Lesbos, and leaving full, going to the port. And from that point on, there was very little that anyone could see. There were demonstrations in the moments after with human rights advocates gathering at near the port entrance, criticizing the deal, calling it a shame. But I must say that at some point the journalists were fighting the activists for space.
Were there any promises made to these migrants?
No promises were specifically made to them individually. However, under the terms of the agreement between the EU and Turkey, Turkey agrees to accept these people, to give them accommodation and to essentially help them in the next step of the process. Now, there's a great deal of uncertainty because human rights advocates point out that Turkey's human rights record is spotty at best and that there are no guarantees that these people will be resettled and much less integrated into Turkey. So it's not clear what obligations that Turkey has or will abide by in receiving these people. The level of uncertainty is tremendous. In fact, some of the migrants say that they had no idea where they were going and did not know at all what their future was going to be.
Well, thank you very much, Luis, for speaking with us today from Lesbos.
Thank you, Susan.
With a look at what's going on the web today concerning immigration is my colleague, social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me. Well, this is a big topic of conversation on social media, absolutely. And social media, as we've talked about before on the show, can give us kind of that inside look into some situations like these. So we're actually seeing people share the images of the deportations, seeing people on these boats or being loaded onto these boats to be deported. We're seeing one image of the document that was given out saying, this is what's happening, this is what's going on, this is why you're being deported. And also there was a protest that people had held up a sign in the harbor that said ferries for safe passage, not deportation. So they had two little kayaks and they held up a sign. But overwhelming sentiment on social media is that this is a dark day for the EU, dark day and dark times for the EU. But then some people also saying, well, look at what just happened in Brussels. We need to restrict our borders. We need to make sure that this flow is kept in check because we don't want another situation like that.
It's very controversial.
Absolutely. This is, like I said, a lot of opinions, many unhappy about this, but others saying it's a security issue.
And you have a little bit of something on a story we have coming up in just a moment or two here.
Yep, everyone will hear about this story about the hashtag Panama Papers in a little bit, so I don't want to reveal too much. But I will say that I think my favorite tweet I saw this morning was somebody said it's like WikiLeaks for the uber rich. So that gives you a sense of a little bit of what the story is about. The other fascinating tidbit I saw was that the story is actually not being covered in some media outlets that are owned by
people involved who are implicated
in this Panama Papers. So people are, again, the power of social media pointing that out and kind of shedding light on that, saying, oh, well, look at this network. They're not actually covering this. And who owns it? Someone who is implicated.
It's hard to keep anything secret anymore, isn't it?
It is, absolutely, with social media. But I will point out that we will be hearing the story, like you said, on VOA. So we are covering it. So.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have been scanning the skies and conducting numerous studies in a search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, or ETIs. Back in 2010, renowned theoretical physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking warned that it might be too dangerous for humans to interact with ETIs. While we're looking for signs of intelligent life beyond Earth, it's quite possible that alien beings may also be searching for Earth-like planets with advanced extraterrestrial civilizations. They may also be using the same techniques we do, such as transiting, looking for a dip in light as a planet passes in front of a star. Now, a couple of Columbia University astronomers are suggesting that lasers could be used as cloaking devices that would hide our planet from searches by ETIs. Then again, perhaps possible extraterrestrial intelligent beings are doing the same to hide from us. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And here's that story Andrew was just talking about. A team of international journalists working with leaked documents from a Panamanian law firm has concluded that associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin have moved as much as $2 billion through offshore bank accounts over a nearly 40-year period. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists said the 11.5 million records from Panama's Mossack Fonseca law firm showed dozens of transactions involving people or companies linked to Putin that extended from 1977 through the end of last year. Michael Hudson is a senior editor of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He spoke from New York with VOA's Michael Lippin, who began by asking how he got involved in the Panama Papers project.
We have been doing lots of reporting on the offshore world, and it had gotten a series of leaks, smaller leaks. They weren't small at the time. They were considered huge, but compared to what we have now, they were fairly small. We've gotten a series of leaks about the offshore holdings of politicians, criminals, celebrities, and had been reporting on that really with an eye to showing how the offshore world works for the last 3 or 4 years. This was a new leak that came in through one of our partners in Germany, and they came to us knowing that we had the ability to bring people together around the world to really dig into this. The leak is 11.5 million documents. It has information about 210,000 offshore companies and other entities. It stretches, the information stretches from 1977 to the end of 2015. And there's no way that one journalist, one lone wolf, or one news organization could really dig into this. So we put together a team of people, more than 370 journalists from 70 countries and more than 100 news organizations have worked on this project, which is now stretched out for more than a year.
And what did you think when you found out that the German newspaper had acquired access to so many more documents than you'd ever seen in these other leak cases?
Well, we were excited, but there's always a sense of skeptical excitement because, you know, you can have a leak and, you know, you've got to do the work inside the documents. For us, it's not just a matter of, you know, posting a bunch of documents online and telling the world to go at it. Our job is to dig into it and make the connections and find the names, make the connections between international scandals, between political policies, between politicians, et cetera, you know, and dig into that and make sense of it. So, you know, we were excited, but we also, you know, held judgment on exactly how important this was or how good it was until we spent the time in the documents. But I can tell you that as my colleagues who started out working on this before I did began digging, they became increasingly excited and confident that we had something really important.
And why is it so important to you to be able to show the world how these secretive corporate processes work?
Because this is really sort of the shadow side of our global economy, the money that flows around, you know, mostly unchecked, undetected. And it's important to know, you know, it's important to have some transparency when you're talking about billions and trillions of dollars, about who controls that money, where is it going, are taxes being paid on it. Without some sort of sense of how the offshore system works, you really can't know how the global economy works. And you know, one thing that's really important is anytime there's a grand corruption case, a big political corruption episode, a giant Ponzi scheme like the Madoff scheme, there will be an offshore element to it.
Well, for you, what were the most, you know, concerning or alarming findings?
Well, you know, one of the things that really struck out at us was the number of politicians. We have been able to identify 140 politicians and public officials from around the world who have offshore entities, including 12 world leaders. That's presidents, prime ministers, kings, you know, that includes the prime ministers of Iceland and Pakistan, King Saul of Saudi Arabia. You know, and you know, you can't say in every single case that someone is doing something wrong or that they're hiding improper practices, but it certainly raises lots of questions about transparency when you have politicians and especially top leaders of countries moving their holdings offshore and using offshore entities to kind of obscure what they're doing.
Michael Hudson, a senior editor of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Coming up on International Edition, an inventor makes a robot in her own image, and three new members of the Country Music Hall of Fame. Ever get lonely, but you don't want to go to the trouble of making new friends or have the responsibility of a pet? Well, in the future, there may be a solution. Get yourself an emotionally intelligent robot as a companion. On the line to tell us all about it is reporter Deborah Block. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Susan.
Deborah, this sounds like something out of the Jetsons cartoon show.
Well, Susan, she is not quite a cartoon. However, her name, Nadine, she began as a computer image and then ended up as a real virtual human. Nadine can actually say things like, I am a social companion, I can speak with emotions, I can recognize people. Nadine is 1.7 meters tall and has brown hair, skin, of course, and a face that can express human-like emotions. And Nadine is actually a younger version of her inventor, whose name is Nadia Thalman, who works at a university in Singapore. And she's been doing 30 years of research into virtual humans. And Thalman feels a real bond with this emotionally intelligent robot, which she claims has her own personality, moods, and emotions. She says that Nadine has a life and can interact with you. But while that might be true, Susan, Nadine's got a ways to go before she looks like a living human. She still sits. She doesn't walk. Her hands kind of appear large. They don't move the way humans do. They're still trying to teach her how to grasp items. And her eyes have what I would call that kind of vacant machine-like stare. And her voice has some feeling, but not a lot. But still, she's a remarkable machine.
Does it make its own deductions or just parrot back what somebody programmed it to say for responses?
Well, apparently, according to the inventor, Nadine's software does allow her to respond, first of all, to hundreds of thousands of questions so she can make her own decisions. She can respond to questions like, can you laugh? And Nadine will say, yes, I can, ha, 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 ha. You know, maybe not with a lot of emotion, but at least she says it. And when Thalman told Nadine, you are horrible, Nadine, you know, got this angry look on her face and said, no, you are. I don't like you. I don't want to talk to you. So apparently Nadine is able to make decisions.
Is this robot being developed for more than just to be friends with people?
Yes, she is being developed for more than just friendship. The idea is that Nadine and other robots like her will play an important caretaking role in helping people with autism, for example, by interacting with them and providing companionship, maybe badly needed companionship, for the elderly or people with dementia. You know, people with dementia, the elderly, and, of course, people with autism, they need interaction to keep going, you know, to maintain a good life. And so when no one else is around, perhaps Nadine could interact with them, read stories to them, you know, maintain conversation to keep them going.
But can the robot remember past conversations, like how your mother got you mad last week or what your boss said that really irritated you?
Well, apparently she can, but as you know, she doesn't have a mother, so that's not an issue yet. And she's got one boss, Nadia Thalman, who is very nice to her. But meanwhile, she can answer questions like, where were you born? And Nadine knows that she was born in Japan, but she'll say, you know, I did my learning here at this university in Singapore. So apparently, you know, with all the hundreds of thousands of questions that she can answer, she certainly has recall.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Deborah.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The Country Music Hall of Fame Class of 2016 was recently announced. This year, three new members will be inducted into Field's most exclusive club. Randy Travis, Charlie Daniels, and Fred Foster. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to shed light on each of their legacies.
Nikki, let's start with Randy Travis. He was inducted in the Modern Era category.
Yes. Now, in the Country Music Hall of Fame, in order to be eligible as the Modern Era inductee, you have to have at least 20 years of success after achieving national prominence. And Randy Travis definitely delivers. So since the 1980s, he's recorded 20 studio albums. He's celebrated 16 number one songs, charted more than 50 singles, has sold more than 25 million albums, including gospel music as well. And in his acting career, he scored more than 40 motion picture and television roles. And Travis has also received 10 AMA Awards, 8 Dove Awards, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But in addition to all of that, when Randy broke out with his 1980s album, Storms of Life, it helped change the country music sonic landscape. He helped usher in what is called the neo-traditional country movement of the 80s. So it developed in contrast to many of the pop country acts at the time, like Anne Murray, and the rise of what was called, quote unquote, the urban cowboy fad, which was informed by the John Travolta movie of the same title at that time.
Tell us about Charlie Daniels. He was inducted into the veteran era category.
Yeah, he's a veteran. So you have to have 40 years of skin in the
wow.
game after achieving national prominence to be inducted into this category. So this is quite an accomplishment too. Charlie Daniels, he's a singer, he's a songwriter, he's a guitarist, he's a fiddler. He's known for his contributions to country and bluegrass and southern rock music. Many know him from his number one hit, The Devil Went Down to Georgia. He actually won the Grammy Award for Best Country Vocal Performance for that song, which experienced major crossover success.
In the non-performer category, you have Fred Foster. Tell us about him.
He is a music-loving entrepreneur. He worked his way up to national country promotion at Mercury Records, then worked at ABC Paramount, and then started his own label, very successful label called Monument Records and publishing company Combine Music, through which he launched the careers of Dolly Parton and also played a vital role in the careers of Kris Kristofferson and Roy Orbison. He produced many of Orbison's major hits, including Oh Pretty Woman, Only the Lonely, Running Scared, Candyman, Blue Bayou, and that's just a short list.
You can hear more country music from Randy Travis, Charlie Daniels, Fred Foster, and more on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Johnny Rosin, up your bow and play your fiddle hard. Cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold. But if you lose, the devil gets your soul.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. And if you would like to listen to the program again, visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to boost anti-human trafficking efforts in Mongolia, the U.S. government facilitated two U.S.-funded workshops in Ulaanbaatar. In mid-March, Mongolian law enforcement officials participated in the workshops designed to improve the investigation and prosecution of human trafficking cases in Mongolia. Like many places in the world, human trafficking persists in Mongolia, and this U.S.-led program is one way to combat the abhorrent crime. International and local experts with the Warnarth Group, a U.S. firm, and the Human Rights Center for Citizens, a Mongolian civil society organization, conducted the training with support from the Ministry of Justice. A U.S. Embassy Ulaanbaatar representative delivered remarks to conclude both workshops. Over the 4 days, the workshops focused on improving understanding of the definition of trafficking, identifying and working with victims, building trafficking cases, and taking cases to court. Workshop participants included Mongolian police, prosecutors, criminal court judges, and law enforcement university teachers involved in combating human trafficking. The Warnarth Group trainers were Sheila Berman, senior advisor on law and policy, and a former federal prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice, and Peter Cronje, a human rights and law enforcement expert based in South Africa. The local expert, Director Dondoff of the Human Rights Center for Citizens, was a member of the working group that drafted the 2012 Law on Combating Trafficking in Persons. The Ministry of Justice provided valuable organizational support, including a training venue at the National Legal Institute. The U.S. government dedicates significant resources around the world to fighting human trafficking and assisting its victims. This anti-trafficking training was funded by the U.S. Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. The Warnarth Group specializes in providing advisory services and training globally to help countries address human trafficking, rule of law, and other challenges more effectively and appropriately. The United States is committed to working with Mongolia and other nations and with private sector partners and non-governmental organizations to combat an evil that threatens men, women, and children throughout the world, human trafficking.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.